CataractCoach.com. Welcome back to our podcast. Today we have episode 17 with Professor Jorge Alio. Professor Alio has been on the forefront, the cutting edge of cataract, refractive, anterior segment, corneal, glaucoma surgery for many, many years. He's based out of Alicante, Spain, and he has done both the private practice, you can see the huge visual center he built, plus he's done the academics and chairman of a department and grown a huge following in his department of ophthalmology. So he's done amazing things in ophthalmology, and he's truly quite a leader in this. In terms of publications, you may be blown away. He has hundreds of peer-reviewed publications, a couple out of 1,000. So clearly the man has an incredible scientific brain, but also an incredible surgical brain. And we had a great conversation today talking about all things anterior segment surgery. And he's got some great insight as to your future. I bet you'll enjoy. Check it out. So welcome to our Cataract Coach podcast. Today we have Professor Jorge Alio from Alicante, Spain. Professor Alio has done so much in ophthalmology. He is one of the top authors in the history of ophthalmology. Unbelievable. The work ethic is second to none. He's written many books. You see on the podium across the planet. And he's a prolific surgeon, ultra high volume. And has even created an empire of eye surgery there in his hometown. So I want to welcome you, Professor Alio.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for your invitation today. It's great to be here. Joining colleagues of the States and worldwide, because it's always good. You know, interaction means learning, and it's always positive. It brings a lot of good vibrations for me. Thank you.
For sure. So tell me about your new book. You have a new book with Bobby Osher and Burkhard Dick and you. The three of you have written a new book about cataract surgery. Tell me more about this book.
This is the book. Okay.
Fantastic.
Yeah, you know, the book has been edited by us, because we thought that there was a place in the international literature about cataract in especially difficult cases and complex situations. We have, because of the experience of more than 30 years in surgery, the experience in all these topics, but also we have the experience of other surgeons. There are many good surgeons now worldwide in which, based on high volume expertise and talent, they have got innovations and new approaches in order to solve problems that before were very difficult to solve or impossible. Not only that, we have new technologies that are available that it makes it possible to do things that before were not done in a proper way. And so we thought that this was the moment to upgrade all this knowledge in a book in which we have contributed, each one of us, about one third. And then we have got the contributions from other sources that indeed have been tremendously successful. We have a book with a lot of information, but also with a lot of videos, because surgery has to be watched.
Fantastic.
And obviously, yes, you cannot watch 20 authors in the different places. It's impossible today, but you can see which is their expertise and the way in which they deal with especially difficult and complex cases in a successful way. I have to tell you today that this book is based on evidence. It's not based only in opinions. It's not based on artistic behavior.
Evidence-based.
So whatever you will read there is because we have the author has the evidence, has been published with series of cases, has been peer reviewed, and even the book has been peer reviewed. So whatever you see,
wow,
you can see that is a peer review process, both from the authors and both from the editors. And so it's a percolated information. Yes.
Give us an example of some of the difficult or challenging or complex cases that you're talking about in the book.
You know, let me tell you two interesting chapters. One is about bilensectomy. Today, we started implanted a phaco IOLs about 30 years ago, and obviously many of these patients have cataract or complications that have to be now solved. And so bilensectomy has become about 20% of my practice now in Alicante, which is a lot, you know. And that means that we have developed expertise in angle-supported lenses, difficult to expand many times with many difficulties, area-supported lenses, which are the most challenging ones to expand, and a posterior chamber lenses of silicone like the PRL and others that now have become obsolete in part, but they are in the patients, you know, and we have described and we have illustrated with videos how we can approach each one of these cases in a successful way and
sure,
evidence-based with publications that support what we say.
So it sounds simple for a posterior chamber lens, either the PRL made of a silicone or let's say a Collamer based Vizion ICL. Those are pretty easy to remove through a standard 2.75 incision. How do you remove iris claw lenses, especially the older generation that are not foldable? You have to make a big incision, right?
Yeah, you need to go to the sclera. I do have a front incision, and from this front incision, then I dissect the sclera, and I try to minimize the induction of astigmatism. At the same time, the sclera incision makes it very easy for the lens to slide out from the eye, as far as you can detach it properly from the iris, which is the most challenging condition, because some of them have perforated the iris. But yes, this is all these cases are for sclera. Then you have to know how to suture the sclera in order to minimize the astigmatism induction.
Sure. And then you do phaco. Let's say if they need cataract surgery at the same time, you do it through the same incision or you do a separate incision?
No, separate incision. We close the incision, then we open as a regular technique. We might use microincision as surgery with 1 millimeter incisions, or we go to 2.2 phaco calcification surgery. We do the surgery, and then depending on the lens that we are going to implant, if it fits through 2.2 millimeters, then we use the 2.2 millimeter incision for the implantation. Some lenses, because of the power, should be with a larger incision. Then we don't mind to reopen the scleral incision and to implant the lens to the scleral incision. We try to minimize the incision size of the cornea, and if we need to work from the scleral twice, it doesn't matter.
So it's interesting for these patients. You've had these patients in your clinic for many years. When they were younger, let's say maybe 25 years old, they got a phakic IOL. That lasted them maybe 25 years, 30 years, till they're 55 years old. Now they remove the phakic lens, now make them pseudophakic with cataract surgery, and now you can carry them the rest of their life. So it's kind of a continual care of the patient, tailoring it as they get older.
Absolutely true. And you know, this is the beauty of that, because the patients are, after 30 years, following you and trusting in you. This is very important, because you cannot disappoint these patients. But not only that, you need refractive precision, because these patients were initially implanted because refractive purposes. So this is real refractive lens surgery. And by lensectomy means not only cataract surgery of good quality, safe, of course, for the endothelium, no complications, but should be refractively precise. You have to use EROF or multifocal lenses, depending on the convenience, depending on the patient profile, but the patients are requesting from you and are following you because you solved their problems 25, 30 years ago, and they request you to solve the problems now. This is very interesting and emotionally talking from a surgeon perspective, a tremendous positive impact in order to know that the trust that the patient is doing on you has to be followed by your expertise in doing this job in a proper way.
So we must, as ophthalmologists, be not just a cataract surgeon or not just a refractive surgeon, but we have to do the whole spectrum. Corneal refractive surgery, phakic IOLs, refractive lens exchange, cataract surgery. We have to offer everything then.
Absolutely. You know, this is why we edited, of course, 9 years ago, about refractive lens and corneal surgery in our university. You can see this course, which is 500 hours of teaching activities online in English, which is refractive surgery online course. Refractive surgery online course. Please go there and you will see how we approach this. I do think, believe me, that the modern anterior segment surgeon is a refractive surgeon, is a must, should be an excellent lens surgeon, should use modern lenses perfectly, and should be in cornea as well, because cornea surgery follows many refractive patients, and many refractive surgery patients like the patients with corneal graft needs refractive surgery later on. So you have to be a comprehensive, complete surgery in terms of medical education.
But also even glaucoma surgeries, minimally invasive glaucoma procedures at the time of cataract surgery. You have to incorporate that as well.
That's true. This is one thing that is expanding our profile. Glaucoma surgery is a specialized, subspecialized surgery. But for cataract surgeons, these microstents and all what is the MIGS technology is coming for us. You know, it's not coming for the glaucoma surgeon. Glaucoma surgeon has a different profile. They treat more difficult cases. They treat cases that have real disability. But we usually treat patients with ocular hypertension or early glaucoma, patients that have 3 molecules in use when you approach cataract surgery. And this is the right moment for the right cataract surgeon to solve the right. I totally agree with you. Yes.
Wow. So that's a very interesting case. So that's the phakic lens patient who gave either the lensectomy plus the phakic lens removal. Tell me about another interesting case that you cover in the book.
And that's very interesting, the iris substitution, iris reconstruction and iris substitution. You know, we have these two approaches. One is to reconstruct the iris, which is, can be done in case that you have no extensive atrophy, you have no tissue that has been lost because phakic has atrophy in the coronal stroma. And if you don't have this, then you have to go to artificial iris. Artificial iris was a dream before. We had the Morcher lenses, no longer available, unfortunately, that were ugly but effective. Now we have foldable pieces of iris that you can have in different colors. You have, they can have an structure, and believe me, they look very similar to the human iris. Yeah. And in many cases, you have to see carefully whether there is a difference. They are doing very well. The challenge is that you have the iris with no lens sometimes, and then you have to implant a lens in the iris to implant for the complex. Yeah. All the composite that you have to do in the iris, and then you know that you have to know the technique in order to make this this structure stable in the sulcus. I have implanted many of these, and you know those that are in the casual bag, believe me, are not that much reliable. I have seen patients of me and other surgeons that with time and because of casual retraction, this artificial iris pump out from the casual bag.
Oh.
And then the problem that you have a structure in the anterior chamber. Obviously with a tremendous negative impact on the coronary endothelium. So I prefer the sulcus approach, but suturing because they are not stable in the sulcus. And this is a very important part of the chapter. This is a new type of lenses. Probably you don't have this in the States at this moment, but you will have, because these patients exist. They have a glare disability. They don't use the light properly. You cannot implant a modern lens in these patients because simply talking, it's impossible. They don't manage the light. But once that you use this artificial iris in a proper way, you have both, one, the cosmetic part accomplished, but other, you are opening a new window to IOL implantation that really was not possible before. And this is tricky, but works. And you have an excellent chapter written by Vladimir Pfeiffer of this regard that they invite all of you to read. And this is one of the most important parts, indeed, of the book, indeed. Yes.
Well, it sounds like a fantastic chapter to understand and read for these difficult cases. I didn't realize that if you put the iris implant in the capsular bag, when the bag contracts or capsule contracts, you can dislocate the iris implant. So, what suture do you use to suture? Gore-Tex, Proline?
Yeah, I use Gore-Tex. Is not my favorite, suture. It is because it's bulky, number one. Second, the knots are even more bulky, number two. Number three, if you use the Hoffman pockets, they don't fit well in the pockets and the pockets cannot be closed properly. So I use the Proline. I have to tell you, I have had not that many problems with the Proline the CIF4 suture is my favorite. And, you know, if in 20 years I have to substitute it, I would do. But so far, I prefer the very thin, elegant, adequate needle that we have with a CIF4, and I do not use the Gore-Tex in spite of what many other surgeons are using. It doesn't work well in my hands. I don't think that they are delicate. They are not indeed the caliper of ophthalmic suture, and I declined using them after some cases in which I was with inadequate knots and inadequate bulky knots underneath the sclera. So I do the CIF4 from Ethicon. The Proline Teno.
That sounds fantastic. And that gives good long-term stability.
Long-term stability, we know that it might be not good. But believe me, in my hands has not been that much. I have been implanted for probably 15 or 20 years implants with this lens. And I seldomly see one case with losetted. And if I see one case losetted, I substitute it. It's not a problem. But I prefer that to the Gore-Tex sutures that have an inadequate needle and an adequate caliper and for the purpose of my surgery.
What advice do you give a young surgeon who's finished a residency training, finished a fellowship, but really hasn't gotten experience with these types of difficult or challenging cases? How do you go about learning them? Yes, we'll buy the book and read the book, but how do you go take that book knowledge and apply it to learn it with your hands?
Well, when you have to think how to teach or how to give an advice to a young surgeon, first think how you did it. Because we did it, you know.
Yes.
Sometimes we visit other surgeons, it's possible, But sometimes if the surgeon is in Australia, it's impossible, it's very costly and it's not convenient. They then attend to seminars. Seminars, surgical seminars are good, and you learn a lot from what other people say and source in the seminar. What is true is that they are edited videos, and sometimes they do not represent real life. I've seen surgeries that were 5 minute surgeries, and then when you go to the real place, it's 45 minutes and a lot of trouble. So you need to be aware of that. Number three, a thing that you have in the literature almost everything. For instance, in the book that that we published with Bobby Osher and Booker Dick, we have videos because this is a good learning process. Many surgeons from Latin America, Far East, they cannot travel that much. It's very expensive, and they have no accessibility to this. But in the book, you have the videos, and the video links are really good. I have seen many of your videos, excellent, and they are produced in a didactical way. It tells you about what you have to learn from the surgeon. So my advice is, please try to see first what you want to do. Second, prepare your surgery. Surgery has to be prepared. You have to make a plan, you know. You have to make that strategy and to have a plan A and a plan B, because sometimes plan A is not feasible and you cannot start thinking what to do in the operating room. So prepare your surgeries. And number three, based on evidence. For instance, there is a controversy now about whether to use the scratch suture lenses or the artisan lens behind the iris. This controversy needs to be cleared, you know, because at this moment the surgery with the artisan is very, very fast. But on the other hand, you are exposed to other complications, and the lens can luxate with time as well. I have seen lenses luxated with time in the anterior chamber. Why not in the posterior chamber? We need a study like this. And if you base in evidence your choice, you are going to be with an extremely a successful surgeon for the future of your patients, which is the five. Don't think in the short term, think in the long term as well.
Yeah, so it's interesting. So a lot of times we're used to doing things only on anecdotal evidence. Well, on my experience, but you're saying it's much more important to actually do it evidence-based. Let's look at it. Let's study the patients. Let's do a trial. Let's figure out the true answer.
Yeah. Okay, we are doctors, and that means that we have the science of medicine. The art was separated from science when Koch defined demonstration. So demonstration is when somebody else can do what you do with the same result. Evidence-based means you are using a technique that is not the art of a surgeon, or it's a crazy idea, or it's anecdotal information. It's reproducible. If your reproducibility is mandatory in science, and you have to see that the surgeon that advised you to do something has peer-reviewed publications. Peer-reviewed publications means serious doctor, because you are getting your data, you are analyzing your outcomes, you refer your outcomes to others, and then others pay attention to which have been your results and agree with the publication. This is a percolated information. Go evidence-based, don't go heart-based, and not far-based, emotional-based, okay?
No, that's a very good point. Now, speaking of peer-reviewed journals and peer-reviewed articles, I cannot believe how many peer-reviewed articles you have produced. It must be 1,000? It's some incredibly high number?
Over 800, yes.
800? That's as much as, you know, 20 really prolific ophthalmologists will do, 800 total, 40 each, right? Wow, that's amazing. So tell me, you built up a whole team here. Your clinic, you've built into a huge, big empire, basically. How did you get started, and how did you grow it?
Well, you know, this is the story of my life, you know. I became chairman of ophthalmology very young, because in Spain there's an open competition, and then you show that you have the capabilities, you have the background, and you have to go through a very complex exam, then you are appointed. And then when I arrived in Alicante, I was not from Alicante at all. I was educated in Madrid, and actually I was birthed, my original country is not Spain even, you know. But then when I arrived, the problem and the advantage were the same. I was very young, but at the same time, I had no infrastructure. And so I had time to develop a new structure. It was the youngest university in Spain, and they allowed me to start an American project, because basically what I did has been made in most of the important institutions, Bascom Palmer, Johns Hopkins. They, all these institutes started with a person a visionary person thinking in the future, putting their money, investing and creating value and creating talent. And this is what I started with my colleagues and my collaborators. And finally, because I thought that the way to develop medicine and develop my academic career couldn't be in the old standards. New standards means investment. New standards means technology. New standards means renovation, you know. And you cannot depend on decisions of persons that takes 1 year to decide that a new instrument has to be purchased for the benefit of the patients that you know that works. So I became, with agreement of the university, independent taking this decision. The investment was made by me. And finally, we did a continuous reinvestment of our revenues in order to create larger value. Now we are, with us, obviously, a very stable condition. We belong to a corporation, and this corporation is not only in Spain, but also in Europe. It's called Biomed, and it's the most important and extensive ophthalmic organization in Europe. So innovation, investment, quick decisions for following evidence or following science. Sometimes you don't have the evidence, but you know that this can be true. And then you have to program research, and clinical research brings the evidence necessary for innovation to have credit. And this is the way in which we created papers. I am very good in writing papers. Going to the States, I can write one paper going there and one more coming in.
You don't sleep on the airplane. You write a paper.
Yeah. So I if I have the data and I have the literature, I can write the paper straightforward. And evidence-based means analysis of your results. This is a way in which we have created our structure, evidence-based, demonstration, new technology, and new ideas. New ideas that come with you or come to you. You can develop the idea, but many times it's the idea, for instance, of you, Uday, that gives to me an advice, or I see you, and then it makes inspiration. Inspiration makes creativity, but creativity is not to paint something, it's to create a value for your patient. And then you have to follow the rules of clinical research. Clinical research has to be well organized. You have to cooperate with the industry. The industry is a key factor in our development, because the industry obviously wants to be successful and to get money, but they are helping us constantly. You know, without the industry, we couldn't do what we do today. So I work with the industry a lot. I appreciate a lot the support. Believe me, in my many years of collaboration, believe me, I have never had an ethical problem with any company. If I had bad results, they were bad. If with the good results, they were good. I have to say that we have very reliable industry, and they are very respectful with medical science. And that's my point. So this is how we created the clinics, we created the organization from scratch, from nothing. And finally, we have created an international cooperation, and we have published at the same time papers that bring scientific value of what we do.
And it sounds like all of it is about putting the patient first. What is best for the patient?
Exactly. This is the point, because finally, we are doctors, vocational doctor. I'm a vocational doctor. I became a doctor, and the first of my family didn't want me to be a doctor. They thought that I could have a better and more successful career, less time consuming in other areas. But I am a vocational doctor since very, very young. And believe me, I think it's the best profession we can have. We are working in our hobby. So ophthalmology is my hobby. I never tire, because I think that you are trying something that you don't enjoy. Believe me, that's absolutely true.
Here on Cataract Coach, a lot of our viewers are younger, let's say age 30 to 50, and a lot of them are trying to decide, should they do academic world of ophthalmology, the private clinic world of ophthalmology, maybe government hospital? You have experience in everything. How do they decide what's best?
Well, I am an academic doctor because my father was a philosophy teacher. So I have been in academics deeply influenced by my father, not because he wanted me to be an academic doctor. He didn't want me to be a doctor even, but because I really realized the value and the essence of teaching. Teaching means to learn. Teaching means to learn yourself first, to teach the others. And this is the way in which I became an academic ophthalmologist. I think academic ophthalmologist is the most attractive career, because it is, you are a doctor, you apply your science, you analyze your resource, and you create science, and finally you educate in the science to the others. So it's a full cycle. Obviously, others can have a different approach. can have a different education, a different culture, and you can be a purely professional doctor, fully devoted to your patients and to your personal issues. Sometimes you can be an entrepreneur and to be a business doctor as well. I don't like that much, you know. Thinking only money is not the way to create good medicine. Good medicine means spending money sometimes and to lose money, but finally you gain money because you have better results. And all this scope and complex things, so a series of things made me to be academic doctor entering into business as well, because you cannot understand our society without business. Business is the way to move ahead. You cannot depend only on grants. You cannot depend on supplies that come from third parts. You need to create your own resources. And if you believe in what you do, to apply this income to your resources makes a lot of value for you, obviously. And this is how a medical education should include a business education. I have seen many, many times in the medical school, we need to have a number of credits devoted to education for doctors in business. Business education means how to analyze accountability, how to analyze what is value created. You should not be an economist, but you need to understand what is a business inside. And this is something that makes a lot of credits and maybe will be like a mini MBA for doctors. I've been this part of education that we miss. I had to learn all of this by myself, making mistakes obviously many times, but we include medical education in our medical school, a mini MBA on medical practice and business. It should be of tremendous value for all our students when finishing the career that have to face a real world where economy works based on business, investment, revenue.
Yeah, that's a very important thing, because you're correct. We don't teach anything in business in medical school or even in residency or ophthalmology fellowship. There's almost zero business learning. But if you don't have a successful business, you can't take care of your patients.
Obviously, you can be not doing well with your practice. Your practice can be not successful because of you and because of your lack of education in business, which is a very important and negative issue in our education. So those colleagues that are listening to us and they are joining up, try to get a mini MBA. MBAs takes a lot of time, and probably if you are in a business practice, you cannot take that, but you can devote 2-3 months to an MBA part-time, for instance, 4 hours a day, and this will, in my opinion, increase your practice, will increase your knowledge about what is the real world in the practice. And basically, if you are entering private practice, it's mandatory to do it, mandatory.
That's very interesting. What do you think is the future coming for us in cataract surgery? Will we ever get an accommodating lens? Will we get more precision in IOL calculations? What's coming for us in the future, do you think?
Yeah, you know, the future is here today. I think that we are at the end of a process in which we had first monofocal lenses, then primitive multifocals, then more developed multifocals, then we had different types of multifocals. Finally, we have five types of depth lenses, but the final goal is accommodation. Accommodation has not been accomplished yet. The most of the accommodating lenses that have been offered have been fake news sometimes, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But we have been working for 18 years in accommodating lens, which is based in the sulcus, which is quite an innovation. We have published several papers on this in American Journal of Ophthalmology, ERS. You can go through that with my name. And this lens works. We have experimental animal work in monkeys. And then we have clinical cases in phase 3 that demonstrates that we have an accommodated lens that moves in the sulcus. Once that we have a lens that can adapt to the distance without multifocality, without glare, without the Foti phenomena, really this will make the final change in IOL surgery, because the accommodation is what we look for. At this moment, this lens should be at the sulcus, because the back is an inadequate place for an accommodated lens, because it's a membrane. But a membrane, once that is empty, it lacks of any anatomical value, anatomical meaning, and then becomes fibrotic. And becomes fibrotic means no elasticity, and the lens cannot move. In the sulcus is different, and if you look to our experimental animal studies, you can see that the 5 years, the forces generated in the cellular body still can move properly a lens implanted in the sulcus, and this is what we have been focused on. So lenses, accommodated lenses, are the future, you know. But still, we're at the beginning, but at the end process of a long time development with monofocus and multifocus and recently though. Then we still have punctual cataract surgery. Still today, we have to open 2.2, but you know that we do, some of us, surgery through 1 millimeter. The idea will be at 23 gauge, like in vitrectomy.
By manual.
Exactly, by manual, with adequate energy that makes you to be feel comfortable, because should not be an art for some surgery, should be a science for all doctors that want to learn it properly. And then to eliminate the everything that we have, cataract or lens surgery without a cataract, will be much more safe, will be much more controllable. Probably we shall make less negative effect at the vitreous, which is the main problem with cooperate a young person of cataract, because the vitreous is attached. And finally, we can implant a lens that should be adaptable to this size, injected in whatever, in my opinion, at this moment is the surface. Might be that the future, this dream of having a product, a material in the casual bag seal and working will be feasible. I do think that will be feasible. And this requires a new technology that was with an old idea being successful. And finally, we have, obviously, the outcomes. The outcomes of the patients are refractive. And this refractive precision, you pointed out, is very important. We have this intraoperative aura technologies that in Europe has not been that popular, you know, because even that you can analyze what is the outcome, you know that the predictability at the second or first month will not be exactly that. So we need to create probably an artificial intelligence system to tell us which are the variables that are not possible to be calculated, that make us, with all the analytical biometrical methods that we have, to finish in that perfect adapted lens optical power to be a proper adequate for the purpose of the lens that we implanted. And finally, no drops. I think that dropless cataract surgery is the, I'm doing that now, you know, I use intraocular steroids, low degree. I have blowout totally macular edema from my practice. Obviously, antibiotics are necessary for 5 days, but what a tremendous step forward. The patients leave our recovery room with no drops, because many of them are elderly. Many of them will not use the drops properly. Many of them will not have anybody to put the drops in their eyes, sure, and they make mistakes. So I think that dropless cataract surgery is part of the future that is coming. So accommodative lenses, micro-incisional surgery, minimizing the incision to the level of 1 millimeter, 20, 23, 25 gauge, and a dropless surgery is something that we should see, in my opinion, in the coming 5 years in our practices.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, we used to do, 10, 15 years ago, there was a popularity of bimanual cataract surgery, where in the left hand, let's say, you had an irrigating chopper, in the right hand, you had a phaco needle with no sleeve. And that was 2 incisions, about 1 millimeter each. Why didn't that gain more popularity? Why did we go back to coaxial?
Yeah, well, I was one of the guys moving this ahead, you know. We had a lens that was thin optics, that we rolled the lens in our fingers, and we implanted it through 1 millimeter. So this was feasible at that moment. That was the popularity at that moment. The problem is that thin optics didn't work well optically, and finally the company disappeared, but the patents are still in an important company, which is Boston. Let's see what happens in the future. But what is true is that if you cannot start and finish the cataract procedure through the same incision, many surgeons are discouraged. Many surgeons think that, well, to run through a new training program, learning how to do microincision, learning how to use the ultrasound or lasers, because lasers were available at that moment, not working well, but could work in the future. But to open again for 3 millimeter lens for a 2.2, better to go through a 2.2 from the beginning and finish. This is the point that make this discovery not to be successful. Was successful, but was not popular. Popular because it's more difficult. If you cannot finish the surgery through the same incision, that means that you break the concept again. And finally, this is coming a big, I'm sure, in any future in which we can have this lens again, implantable for 1 millimeter, in the sulcus, in the back, or any place, accommodative or enough. And this is the progress that will make again a revival of microincisional cataract surgery in this coming 5 to 6 years. The lens will move the topic, not the surgery. Surgery is done, so we know how to do it. We need the lens to go through 1 minute.
But it's interesting, is the same surgeons who say, well, if you have to make an incision for the lens anyway, I'll just use that. They also sometimes do bimanual irrigation aspiration. So they already have the two bimanual incisions and the fake, the main incision for the lens.
Exactly. You are the surgeon and you know that with bimanual, you reach 360 degrees with a cortex removal, epithelial cell removal, you want to remove them. You have access to all the eye. To do 2.2, you have a fixed finger in the eye that is not that elegant, let me tell you. And finally, you don't have mobility. So definitely bimanual is better. Bimanual is better, but we don't have the bimanual technique at this moment much with the adequate lens to convince the surgeons, ethical surgeons, to go through.
For the accommodating lens, how many diopters of accommodation do we need? 2, 3, 4, 5, how many diopters do we need?
You know, we need to be spectacle independent, 3 diopters. To be spectacle independent in the long term, we need more because accommodative fatigue is a function that needs to be accomplished in a more poor. The real thing is that we cannot get that much today. You know, we had a lens that was the new lens created with a friend, Joshua Bindun in Israel. We got up to 8 diopters, but it was with a material that was not compatible with human implantation, and so we declined to develop that. But that demonstrated to us that we could get up to 6 or 8 diopters of accommodation with adequate materials. What we get now with the lens, with the luminal lens, which is the one that I use and I have been developing along the last 18 years with the Acolyx company, is about 3 diopters maximum. 3 diopters is enough or not? Well, let me tell you that phase 3 study of our patients are spectacle independent, happy, and we have engineers, we have doctors, colleagues, non-ophthalmologists yet, but colleagues, and we have very, very devoted patients to office work, and they are spectacle independent. The lens now with 1 to 3 diopters works well, but we have discovered that we have some cell accommodation in code in the lens. We are still investigating why and how this cell accommodation works, because it's not a need-off effect like the ones that we have now in the market. It's a different one, but probably it's a new type of optical behavior that this accommodative lens, at least the Lumina, has to add a value to the real accommodation to get this excellent result, which makes the patients to be spectacle independent. And believe me, this is something that has been published. The new paper is being produced now with a phase 3 study, and the lens will be, it's already with CE mark, and will be available, I hope, more or less at the end of this year or beginning of next year.
Oh, fantastic. And this is curvature changing then?
No, it is true, based on Albrecht's principle, 2 sinusoidal surfaces, varifocal, when sliding one into the other, moved by the axillary body, creates a continuous chasing the power of the lens. Oh,
wow.
So they are 2 sinusoidal frontal plane. They are not moving backwards and forward. It's a totally different concept. It's an Albrecht's principle. Albrecht's principle merits the Nobel Prize in 1953.
Wow.
And the base of all automatic refractors. Auto refractors have been based in this principle, and especially subjective auto refractors have been all made in this technology.
So you're able to harness that power from the ciliary muscle to get the movement.
Ciliary body circular, so the forces are generated in a centripetal way.
Yes.
And you have one lens that is like one into the other. So it's a dual lens, but there are 2 varifocal surfaces sliding one into the other, creating a continuous change in the power of the lens and the power of the eye.
Well, that's fantastic. What a brilliant idea. I like the idea. Like an auto refractor.
Nobel Prize idea.
Yeah, but obviously. Now tell me, for your dropless regimen, so no more drops, what medications are you putting? How are you delivering them? Is it subtenons, intracameral, intravitreal? Where are you doing these medicines?
You know, I use, I participated in the ESCRS ciprofloxacin in the study, you know, and so I was at that moment attracted already by the idea of putting in the anterior chamber 0.1% ciprofloxacin in order to avoid the endophthalmitis, and the demonstration was obvious. We decreased 15 times less the frequency of the endophthalmitis. And now what we use is the same. We use the fluoxacin, Vigamos as well. Vigamos is an off-label use, as you know, but it works. And so with this, the issue is, do we need drops in the post-op? Medically, legally, Probably, yes, because we have to educate our society that this is safe. But what I do is I use the furoxime impregnated incisions. So I'm hydrating incisions with the furoxime. And at the end, I put 0.1, 0.2 cc's in the third chamber. In doing that, you have a minimum MIC deposit of the furoxime that lasts for the first 24 hours. And you have, because of the clearance of the aqueous is faster, the clearance of the aqueous makes to be about 1 hour with MIC useful in the third chamber. That means the only place through which a micro can enter in the eye is through the incisions. You have 24 hours the protection of the incision with furoxime or Vigamox, that's fine. This is something that makes you to be in the safe area as far as you don't have leakage. I don't think that modern operating rules have any possibility to have a real contamination today. You don't break the rule. But you have patients that have leakage. These small leakage can lead to a contamination in the post-op in the first 24 hours. So this is why we use the incision, antibiotic impregnation, and hydration for that. And second, we use 10% transcinolone diluted in the third chamber, just 0.1. And this transcinolone is a kind of cloudiness at the beginning, but finally, in 12 hours, it is in the Irish scripts, and from there, it lasts 6 weeks. Believe me, it works very well. You don't have any inflammation, but moreover, you don't see macular edema in my patients, have visually disappeared, unless you have complications. Normal cases, we have no complications now with macular edema. Obviously, this is preliminary information, has not a peer review evidence, but is what I'm doing in order to move ahead this Robles idea. I don't like non-steroids, and I have no use of that. So basically, what I see now is an steroid slow release for 6 weeks that has in a minimal concentration enough to control the very low degree of inflammation that we have in the post-op, antibiotic in a way that will protect the patient for 24, 14 hours, and that's it, you know, and the patients in this way are less affected by the lack of compliance, less affected by ocular toxicity, and they don't touch the eyes, especially because many elderly patients, when they are putting the drops, they touch the eyelid and they open the incision sometimes. This is the point, you know.
So it's cefuroxime, usually, or sometimes Vigamox, intracameral 0.1 to 0.2 cc's of 1%. And then you're also using that same solution to do hydration of the corneal incisions, to seal them and also act as like a slow release over the first 24 hours. And then inside the eye for the steroid, it's triamcinolone, 10 milligrams per cc, and then you're doing a total of 1 milligram, 0.1 cc's?
0.1. So it's a mini flux. It's really very low, very low amount. 0.1, 0.05, 1.5 is what I do. 0.1 is very low quantity, but it's enough. And 10% is extremely low. I don't see ocular hypertension. I might be lucky so far. But this brings to me an excellent post-op with a very good patient satisfaction and, you know, saline eye, white eye, nothing. You know, believe me, it's feasible to have this type of therapy. I know the limitations because of the FDA and many, many pharmacological controls, but many times you have pioneer idea that this needs years to develop. But dropless surgery is completely affordable, it's cheap, it's better for the patients, it's much more reliable, and finally you get better outcomes.
And even though the anterior chamber turns over so quickly, every 90 minutes, 100 minutes, you still have enough of the particles in the iris crypts that it stays active for a long time.
Because they are particles. They are not a soluble. They are particles, and they are suspension. A suspension is ones that you put, it is deposit. The deposit is created in the iris scripts. Actually, the next day, you seldom see anything or small dust on the lens and disappears. But that makes a difference, you know. Probably the amount that is left is enough for the purpose. It's empirical, but it's working. But deserves attention. This should not be solutions, should be suspensions. And suspensions are kept in the eye in microparticles, not observable, they don't interfere with the vision, and the patients are, believe me, totally covered.
We should also say, though, your patients have very little inflammation. I've seen you do live surgery. You are a fantastic surgeon. So your surgeries are very brief, very minimally invasive, very delicate, very gentle to the tissues. If you're a young doctor just starting off and you've done less than 1,000 cataracts, you may need a little bit more inflammation control.
I agree. You know, this is not to be adopted today. But, you know, new ideas have to be used by those that really are capable to use them properly and followed by clinical research. So I think that information is what we need, and to have the concept that dropless surgery is feasible. It's not here today, sure, but will happen in the future. 1 millimeter incision lenses are not here today, but were in the past and will be in the future. And this is the point and the driving force that we have to move into a better type of surgery and better outcomes in it.
Now that I have become presbyopic with the gray hair, I would love to have my accommodation returned to me.
Yeah. Well, this is also pharmacology. You know, I'm very, very interested in pharmacology of presbyopia. And, you know, there has been a very large move in the States, especially along this topic. I'm using drops for my early presbyopic patients successfully. In my wife, I have to tell you that she's...
What are the drops?
I use the Bejarano, Felipe Bejarano, Colombian colleague, patented a combination of drops, of molecules that makes not the pupil to be very meiotic, but moderately meiotic or even nothing, but creates a tonic ciliary body. And with this, one diopter, 1.5 can be accomplished. And many young people, young is 45, you know, take 45, they are young. They love it, you know, and I think that pharmacology of presbyopia disorders that is probably other molecules, not meiotic, not to mention any special one, but the pharmacology of the drugs that we used in the past for glaucoma, like carbacoline, they are working very well because they move the ciliary body without creating meiosis. Meiosis is one of the ways to create an improvement in vision, but also you move the ciliary body, and some people don't like them because of the theoretical risk of retinal detachment. I think that this is very theoretical, but cannot be ruled out. Those that are not working on the meiosis definitely are, in my opinion, the ones that will be much more acceptable and commercial in the future. But I do believe that this is a move for the future for patients as well.
Wow. Yeah. It's an exciting time to be an ophthalmologist. You have so many innovations on so many different fronts. I think
want to read this mixture of molecules, read my papers, click presbyopia pharmacological treatment, and you will read three papers on this, in which we describe the product, we describe the outcomes, we describe the immediate outcomes in 3 hours, and basically you have a flavor about what we are talking about.
Yeah, I think it's a fantastic time to be an ophthalmologist. I'm like you. Every day I'm thankful that I'm an ophthalmologist, and my work as an ophthalmologist, it's a pleasure. It's my hobby. I do it for fun.
Exactly. How happy we are because of that. Otherwise, not worth it, you know, because we are 12 hours a day nonstop, and this is something because you have enjoyed. If you don't enjoy it, leave it.
That's true. Well, I want to thank you for being on our podcast. I learned so much from you. I also know you had a very busy day in clinic, and now it's finally time for your dinner. And I want to remember now, next time I'm on a long flight and I'm watching the movie or taking a nap, I'm going to think, Professor Alia would be writing a paper right now.
True. I never watch movies in the airplane. But it's very good. You are concentrated, you are alone, and you can do it.
That sounds fantastic. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Professor Alio, and thank you for enjoying our Cataract Coach podcast. We're going to have a new one every week with more interesting guests who are going to tell you about their journey in ophthalmology and what they think the future holds for all of us. I know you'll enjoy it. See you next time.